I think people that control a lot of buying power in the world have finally figured this out. And I think that they're doing everything that they can to you know, take a position size. Now, whether it's a large position size or what, or just a hedge, I don't know, but they're figuring it out. Just look at the people that came to the conference in Nashville. Like, they're figuring it out.
This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
We were talking in Nashville. That was a great week. And I think you really helped crystallize an idea that's been percolating, obviously, in many circles, but now is more pressing to people in the industry post Bitcoin Act bill being put on the floor by Cynthia Lummis. And then obviously RFK and Trump talking about a strategic Bitcoin reserve at the Treasury. But from conversations with yourself, Pierre Rochard, Jack Mahlers, and then listening to your episode of What Bitcoin Did with Luke Grohman, when I was driving back from a flight, I had about an hour and a half drive and listened to that episode. And this idea that Bitcoin could be used to basically save the long end of the curve, because it seems like demand for the long end of the curve, U.S. Treasury bonds, 20-year, 30-year, and now it seems like even 10-year, based off of some tweets that you're sending today, is critical. But before we jump into like how Bitcoin can fix it, I think I saw you were tweeting about one of Luke Roman's recent newsletters, Forest Through the Trees. The U.S. debt problem seems to be getting out of hand, and it's beginning to manifest itself in these treasury auctions. And so the 10-year auction, particularly this week.
Yeah. Yeah. The auctions are getting worse, especially for way out on the duration. That's why they've been doing all the bill issuance. And I mean, that's really kind of the canary in the coal mine for just if there's major issues, you can't convince somebody to buy bonds that they've got to squat on for 30 years at whatever coupon. And the coupons are super low, and people like, why in the world would you buy something that is paying you 3% on the principal when your expectation is that there's no way in hell they can keep inflation under 3%? That's the big question. And so why can't they sell them without there being just a death spiral of lack of demand? That's why. It's because nobody believes the math anymore. And so they're forced to say, okay, well, we're not going to issue the 30-year bond. We'll just issue it at 10 years, and then we'll issue it at 5 years. And then, oh no, we'll issue it for 3-month paper, right? Because that's the only thing people are willing to buy, because they don't even really care about they care about the coupon for sure. I find it fascinating that the coupon's at 5%, which is yielding higher than like the 30-year, which just tells you how jacked everything is. So them moving a shorter and shorter duration issuance is just telling you how catastrophic the fixed income and debt markets have become. And this is the U.S. we're talking about. Like, this isn't like some third world country. This is the U.S. that these issues are at. And every other bond market in the world is a total train wreck too. So, yeah.
Yeah. And the recent issuance of, or the recent dependence on issuing these bills over the longer duration bonds, I mean, many people have surmised that it's because they don't want to roll over and issue 20, 30 year bonds with interest rates as high as they are. But the ramifications of over indexing for shorter durations, these bills, has had somewhat of a stimulating effect to the economy. It's actually injected some liquidity into the economy as well. And I think for the audience to get a feel for just how much they're over indexing, I think typically the auctions, the short term bills are like 10 to 15%, but they've been trending towards 40 to 50% of overall issuance at auction over the last 18 months to 2 years, I believe.
Marty, this was the moment that, because I had that conversation with Luke before this conversation I had with Paulo from Tether. Okay. So in this conversation I had with Paulo, I was like, so what would it take for you to start buying long duration bonds? Like, let's just, because think about it. He's there buying like 3 month paper. He's making 5% on all this annualized. He's making 5% on the principal of all this paper that he's buying to just issue more coins, which are in high demand all over the planet because of the saleability and people that are unbanked. Okay. So he's providing that service. He gets to keep the coupon of 5%. And I asked him, I said, and what he's doing with the coupon, which is just pure profit for him, you know, he's making billions. His last quarter, he made $1.3 billion just on the coupons from all these treasuries these short duration treasuries that he's holding. And he's plowing most of all of that into Bitcoin or some type of like R&D tech that's going to further along Bitcoin development in some areas. But for the most part, he's like plowing it all into Bitcoin, the profits. And so, you know, if you're him, it really comes down to, well, if I would go to the US government and say, hey, if you start issuing like 10-year bonds, 20-year, 30-year bonds, but you back it with, call it 10, 20%, whatever the number is of Bitcoin, he's going to sweep the cash flows into Bitcoin anyway. So that becomes this incentive for him to actually be a buyer of the longer end of the curve. So I bring this idea up to him and I'm just like, so like, what would that percentage look like for you to start buying longer duration bonds? If the US government came to you and said, hey, we'll back the 10-year with this 10-year issuance with 10% Bitcoin in it, would you be a buyer at that? And Marty, his response was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. He basically looked at me and was like, yeah, no way in hell. He didn't say that, but like the look on his face was like, give me a break. Like, no, I'm going to keep buying these 3 month paper and I'll plow it into Bitcoin. Like, I'm not going to deal with that risk of like how much needs to be backed. Right. And this guy is number 18 in the world of buying US treasuries. Like, he has more US treasuries than like most nation, like developed nations that are buying US treasuries. And the pace of his buying is only picking up. Like, next year he'll probably be number 10 for all I know, right? In the world of buying US treasuries. So that for me was such a like landmark moment to like watch his facial expression, like literally laugh me out of the room of like, there's pretty much nothing they could do to like get me to start buying the long end of this curve.
Well, it's an insane predicament they find themselves in. Cause I said, you just tweeted out, Logan, we have the tweet if you can pull it up, but for the first time in 48 years, 10-year US Treasury yields rose in response to a year-on-year decline in world USD liquidity, which in our view was a warning that US debt to GDP, deficit to GDP, and NIIP to GDP are so high that US policymakers cannot over tighten USD liquidity without triggering a US debt spiral. So with that context,
yeah,
in mind, and Paolo's response to that, like, there's literally nothing they could do. Like,
all that says for a person who hears all that, like, all it's saying is the world has finally figured out the math, is basically what that's all saying. Is like, all the buyers of this garbage are running the numbers and they don't believe the numbers. And they don't want to own this garbage. That's what that says. So, you know, the thing that I find so interesting, Marty, that's playing out right now is dollar domination is for people that are watching this, they're saying, okay, well, like, this is weird. What's really weird is the demand for dollars is only going to accelerate from here. Okay. Despite all of this stuff that we're saying. And what you're finding is that the demand for stable coins is going to accelerate from here. Like, I think that the number of, like, just for Tether alone is like 120 billion that they're backing with these 3-month paper issuance that's kicking off 5% coupons. I have no idea what that trajectory is, but like if you told me next year at this time that it was 180 billion that they had backed, it wouldn't surprise me in the least bit. The US needs to accelerate their issuance. The desire around the world for dollars in particular is accelerating. Most people can't, they haven't wrapped their head around Bitcoin yet. They will. It's just that they're so accustomed to the dollar being this, you know, apex predator of currency relative to their local currencies. I don't see the cognitive dissonance on like that versus Bitcoin changing like in the coming year. So the demand for these dollars and the demand for people to want to hold these stable coins in these developing nation states with these crap currencies is just going to accelerate. And what's so fast, so people would look at this and they'd say, yeah, Preston, but Tether is a central bank digital currency in disguise and blah, 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 and like all these other things. And you know what? I'm not going to argue with any of that. Like I'm not arguing that point. But this is the point that I really want to emphasize. The fact that you're watching the explosion in demand for stable coins and the US government needing, basically at this point, they have to have these stable coins because they're the only buyer of this garbage that they're selling. That is not them winning. That is them losing epically against Bitcoin. And I think one of the most misunderstood things happening right now is the expansion and the explosion in like this flooding of US dollars into the global economy is not the dollar winning. I promise you it is literally the polar opposite.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, Tether, we recorded with Tom Luongo like 3 months ago and we brought up Tether. And the market cap was 105 billion. I read a newsletter last week. Market cap was 114. It's already at 115 billion. Checking coin market cap and like quickly climbing. And so that's going to increase. And even though the US government is desperate, they need somebody like Tether to do this. And it's actually comparable because Tether is most accurately compared to the euro dollar market where people can create dollars and back them with treasuries, but it's more of a black box where Tether's more regimented. And that's probably where the intimations that it is the CBDC and is preferable, but trying to be pragmatic here in thinking and like walking through the thought experiment that we started the conversation with, like, and who knows if this ever materializes, but this is the way, like whether it's putting a strategic Bitcoin reserve on the treasury and then figuring out a way to drive demand for long duration bonds by backing them with some amount of Bitcoin, maybe 10, 20% is enough. Maybe it needs to be 30, 40, 50. I think this is actually a roundabout way to solve the debt problem in the long term if you can drive demand for that. And not only that, like this is the way in which you can actually manifest smaller government because the government is getting so centralized and so much bigger because they have this debt spiral problem. And the only way out is to issue more debt and expand the monetary base. And if you had a mechanism to actually pay back that debt, which Alexander Hamilton envisioned when he created the first central bank, he's like, if we're going to issue debt, we have to figure out the ways to extinguish it while we're issuing it as well. And it seems like modern day government has gotten completely away from that concept and sprinkling some Bitcoin into it. It seems like the only way forward to make that possible in my mind.
I agree. But let me talk through why Paulo basically laughed at me. Like if I had to sit in his seat and explain the math behind why he probably laughed at me, this is what the math would sound like. So what this comes down to is what do you think the terminal rate of Bitcoin's buying power is going to be on the other side of hyper Bitcoinization? Okay. Because until you actually know what that, like have a really sound understanding of what that number is, it's so much risk because you either don't have enough or you have an overcapitalized, I don't know if that's the right word. You basically become a massive beneficiary because you underestimated like how valuable it became. So here's what I mean by that. For me, when I think about the value of Bitcoin at like when it takes over, the way we understand $5 to $10 million today is basically one Bitcoin. In my humble opinion, we're somewhere in that ballpark. Okay, it could be 20. It could be one. I don't know. I don't think it's one, but let's just say it's somewhere in that range. And let's just say the number is $10 million of buying power per Bitcoin. So here we are at, and I'm going to use really round numbers. We're above 50,000, but we're just going to say here we are at Bitcoin at 50,000. And if we think that the terminal value is 10 million, right? We have to go 200x from where we're at right now in buying power terms. And that's important because in nominal fiat terms, it's just going to keep running like a German, 1920s Germany chart. But in buying power terms, we got to go 200x from where we're at. So based on that math, you need 0.5% of backing to of whatever garbage debt you're buying, you need 0.5% of it backed by Bitcoin just to break even in buying power terms of the bonds value. So if you have, you got $1 million worth of 30 year debt, you need 5,000, is this math right? You need $5,000 worth of Bitcoin inside of that to basically protect the buying power of the $1 million inside of the bond. So if you're saying that, so where I'm going with this, so if you're Paulo and you're saying, oh yeah, the government's coming to me, they want me to start buying long duration bonds, 30 year bonds, and it needs to have 0.5% of backing in there. What you're really, the risk that you're taking on if you're him is that terminal value of where you think it's going to end up. Because let's say they don't put 0.5% in there, they put 0.25% in there and they want you to buy it. Well, now you just got you lost half of your buying power by buying that long duration bond. Now let's say they put 1% in there. Okay. Well, you just doubled the value of your bond, the buying power of that bond after 30 years. Okay. But this is his opportunity cost. Okay. His opportunity cost is he can go out and buy 3-month paper. He can make 5% on the 3-month paper and immediately just convert it into Bitcoin and not have to worry about any of the risk assumptions of the terminal value. Okay. So that's why when I asked him this question, he looked at me and just laughed because he's like, well, why would I risk anything in all of this math when I can just, It's almost like, what's a good example of just simplifying things, right? Like just keep it simple, stupid. And I'm just going to keep buying the 3-month paper. And you know what? If this really starts to get away from them, it's not going to be a 5% yield. It'll turn into a 7% yield. And guess what? I'm rolling it every 3 months. I'm not rolling this every 10 years. So I don't have to think about it. I don't have to try too hard. And I'll just keep rolling the coupons into Bitcoin after I receive my payment after 3 months. So that's why it's so laughable. It's so laughable. Yeah. And so like I'm coming up with this recommendation with Luke of like, if I'm sitting in the US Treasury's chair, like how can I get people to start buying long duration issuance? Well, that's how I would try to do it. But I think the players on the other side of the table are so astute and understand the math so well that even if they did back it and they came, oh yeah, here we'll back it with 10% Bitcoin or something like that, right? Which would be, based on the math I just described, would actually be pretty entertaining. But I think they're just looking at it so simply like, well, I just don't have to think about it too much. And just, I'm going to roll it every 3 months anyway. So who flipping cares?
Yeah. The Chad bill buyer over the,
yeah. Well, these are the guys that are dominating the trend of buying the issuance, right? Yeah. So good luck convincing the smart guys to like start buying your long duration garbage.
Well, the only thing that would change that, right, is that the curve uninverted, right?
That's a good point. So like, let's say that the short duration started But for the yield to really kind of uninvert itself in a way that it starts to become, a desirable opportunity cost, you actually have to have a real market out there. And you also have to have people to change their underlying assumption of what inflation is. And they have to think that it's less than 5% annualized. And I don't see that happening anytime soon.
No, the only way that would happen is if the Fed and the Treasury let the economic crisis go without bailouts this time around, right?
And even if they did that, Marty, so what we're talking about is let's let the cascading impairment happen. Let's let it really run. Like, let's take our hands off the controls. Let's let all this fractional reserve fiat hocus pocus literally impair itself 50%, like literally have all this liquidity get sucked out of the global economy and like take our hands off the controls and it's death and destruction everywhere. And let's let it run for months, right? First of all, you're going to have banks just blowing up everywhere. You're going to have so much like chaos and destruction that like, but let's just play the scenario, right? Because that's what would have to happen to try to allow some of this to like slow down. I just don't know that the response that then has to come out of that isn't twice as much printing. It's like 10 times as much printing to offset all the impairment and death and destruction in the economy. And so I would suspect that they're actually going to accelerate all of this by taking their hands off the controls for an extended period of time, as opposed to slowing it down.
Yeah. No, and even if there is a temporary period when they do take their hands off the wheels and the yield curve does uninvert, prices come down, even if you're one of these buyers like Tether, you're thinking, all right, maybe there's like a temporary lull, but in the long run, like even buying a 10-year treasury is still risky because within that 10 years, things can completely change.
This is something else that's changed just like very recently, in my opinion. You used to have complete global cooperation between central banks because it benefited all of them collectively to continue to, hey, you know what? You debase your currency for the next like year. We'll allow ours to tighten. And then after that, like Jim Rickards would use this analogy with like you're passing the canteen around the campfire kind of thing. Like you can take a hit and then pass it and then the next person is going to take a hit. Now you're in a situation where the Bank of Japan and the U.S. Fed, both of them are saying we need to drink from the canteen at the same time. Like we can't even afford for you to take a sip. Like we need to be sipping out of this somehow at the same exact time. And because if we don't, like we're both going to die is basically what we're seeing right now. So that's a new dynamic where for all of these years, they've been able to like kind of pass it around the campfire. And now all of a sudden, like we're on the cusp of like one of them dying and like they can't even afford to take turns. So, whatever that means.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network, and you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and they're rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously that's the big topic in the macroeconomic landscape this week is the yen carry trade blowing out. Everybody's a yen carry trade expert now, but I know that you've been covering it on your show and people have been talking about it for some time. And it seems like last weekend was the first manifestation of the market realizing that the Bank of Japan can't even raise rates by 15 bips without blowing up global markets.
And this is the key point on the Japanese trying to raise their rates is inflation got up to 4%. It was pretty sticky. It's down at about 3% right now, but they tried to raise their rates a quarter, 25 bips, right? And they couldn't, and it literally wrecked havoc. And so think of it, like, how in the world is that possibly even remotely a free and open market when you're basically telling the buyer of that to sign up for a guaranteed loss of, you know, close to 3%, and that's being generous. And I think they're also looking that the buyer of that is looking everywhere else in the world and they're saying this inflation isn't going away. And yet they can't even raise 25 bips. Like the, as you know, the bank came out and said, when things aren't stable, we're never going to raise rates. well, they raised rates when things were quote unquote stable. So like what kind of statement is that? It doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. So are we in the acceleration phase right now?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. I think so. I think this coming year is going to get pretty exciting. Yeah.
What do you see playing out from here? Because it seems like this week was a critical sort of checkpoint of people realizing, oh shit, like we are backed into a corner and there's probably nothing we can do to fix this at this point.
I think so much of it comes down to the US election, and some of this opinion is because I think markets are so manipulated, right? So I think that when you look at the current administration, and I think that going into November, the last thing, they cannot have havoc in the markets. That's why this hole got plugged so quickly. I mean, it was like the impairment and the sell-off that was happening was like literally setting records and stuff there on Monday. But then lo and behold, the next day, the Japanese market bid 10%, like right back to where it was. Like, so these markets are, if you think you're playing a fair game here in the traditional system, you are not. Congratulations, you're not. And I think that going into the election, they got to do everything they can to just kind of keep it as stable as possible. When we look at these unemployment numbers, you can see that the system is trying to, the impairment is really catching up, and all this tightening that they did for the last 2 years to try to get the inflation under control is peaked out. You see credit cards maxed out to levels you haven't seen since 2008, 2009. Everybody is hurting for the most part, as far as their ability to kind of deal with all of this, these issues that are systemically global. And so I think that they're going to do every little trick that they can to try to keep things as stable as possible. If you see the market kind of throw a fit, they're going to step in. They're going to try to plug that hole up until November. I think if you see, and this is, you know, unpolitical as I can possibly be, I think if the Democrats lose after November, I think they're going to let the impairment like cascade through the markets. I think if they win, they're going to start pumping it with, you know, as much liquidity as they possibly can. We'll see. But get ready. Cause like this thing is wanting to throw a fit, almost like a child that's been locked in its room for like the whole day because they did something bad and they're like banging on the door. That's kind of like where we're at with these markets right now. Like it's throwing a fit. It needs liquidity. They're feeding it the best they can to like keep things as stable as they can. But, it's about to get spicy, man.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC. $40 off.
One of the levers that the Fed and the Treasury have had to sort of introduce liquidity without doing overt QE is the reverse repo market. And that seems to be draining rather quickly as well. And so when that gets to zero, that's another clock that goes off. It's like, we need to do something here. And I believe it's below $500 billion right now in terms of how much liquidity is in there.
I like to watch, and Lynn watches this too, the global M2. And it has broken out just recently in the past month. That has been going sideways for the last 2 years, the global M2, which I think is probably one of the best indicators of just like global liquidity. So they're already feeding the monster. They're already, you know, dropping more liquidity into the market from a global perspective. Then you just have to like look at all the M2 from around the world and kind of consolidate it. And you'd see that it was going sideways for a good 2 years. But just like this past month, it's starting to break out. When you look at the trend of global M2, it's grinding on this bottom rail that it never goes through. And this is the y-axis is in a log terms. I don't have the chart to pull up for you, but I find this to be a very important thing to look at from the money in the system is expanding or the money in the system is contracting. So I like to use this example of Monopoly to help people kind of to illustrate and for people to understand why prices go down and why prices go up. Let me, there you go.
And this is from last year. So
yeah, that's an old chart. So, but you can see it going sideways. And so that top blue line has broken out. Like it is now at new all time highs. But this is the part I want people to really kind of take away. When we talk about money, okay, we're talking about fiat currency. We're not talking about like real money, which is Bitcoin, which is backed by energy and is scarce and like all those things. But the currency, when the currency expands and the currency contracts, the prices of everything inside of that pond, think of it like a pond of water that's expanding and contracting, right? Most people think money or currency is that thing in their wallet that they paid for a Starbucks with. Okay. It is not, at least the majority of it is not. A very small portion of it are like those monetary baseline units. Most of it are promises. And these promises get broken. And when they do, they contract enormously. So like going to this Monopoly, everybody's familiar with Monopoly and everybody's familiar with when you pass go, you collect $200 and the money supply is expanding and it's getting larger. Okay. The currency is expanding and getting larger. Imagine we were playing this game, but instead of collecting 200, that every time you go around, you have to pay the banker like 500. Okay. And what's happening is the currency units are being extracted out of the game. And as those currency units are being extracted out of the game, what happens to the property values, the equity, the scarce equity on the board? What happens to that scarce equity on the board? Well, as the next person comes around and they land on Park Place and they don't have enough money, what do they have to do? Well, they become a forced seller of the property that they hold, okay, to come up with the payment for the obligation and the counterparty that they just incurred through landing on that spot on the board. And so what happens is a negotiation. So they go, oh, well, I have this railroad. I'm going to sell it. I paid $400 for it, but I'm desperate right now. Everybody on the board knows they're, and everybody else on the board is dealing with the same dynamic where they have to pay an additional $500 every time they pass go. And so they're a little bit worried, and they're concerned that they're not going to have enough cash flow because every time they roll the dice, they have to pay out more and more money, more and more currency. So everybody starts lowballing the offer. Maybe you paid $400 for the railroad, but now you're forced to sell it for $300, okay? Because you have to come up with the cash to fill your counterparty and your obligation, your debt obligation. So then we keep playing this, and the more and more cash is being sucked out of the board, the more and more it's being played. And so what's happening to the prices of all the properties on that board? They're all going down. Of course they're going down. There's less monetary units in the game. And as all these people are paying out more than they're receiving, they're having to recap everything at the table. So when we see Bitcoin, which has no counterparty risk, okay, versus all this fiat that's in the system, and the fiat is drying up because of this thing called impairment and counterparty risk, okay, this is why in these moments where you have cascading impairment over in Japan and there's literally trillions of dollars wiped out because it's fractional reserve based credit, okay? This is why Bitcoin goes down in those moments, because guess what? Guess what market was open Sunday night? Bitcoin was open Sunday night, right? And you could convert it into dollars so that Monday morning at the open, you could actually fulfill all of your counterparty risk, you know, derivatives and all the other garbage that people own. They could actually fulfill that in the denomination that was required to fulfill it, which was dollars or euros or whatever. This is why it goes down in these moments of tight liquidity. And this is why it also goes up. Like if we go back to the monopoly example, let's say the banker is adding $1,000 every time somebody goes past go. Okay. What do you think is going to happen to the prices? Well, you want to own the scarce equity because it's the thing that actually cash flows you, okay, helps you make more money. So you start getting into bidding wars of owning Park Place or whatever the desirable properties are. You almost can't pay enough for it, especially if they're adding a lot of fiat into the system. So this is the game. This is the global game. This is how it works. This is how things get recapitalized. And this is why Bitcoin is very sensitive to these liquidity dynamics. For people that, you know, look at it and say, oh, I'm not going to own Bitcoin. It went down in the moment when I thought it should have gone up. Well, you don't understand how the fractional reserve system works. And if you do, well, then you'd be there buying as much of it as possible because you know what they have to do next.
Yeah. Yeah. Sunday into Monday, I was rolling over, checking my phone, seeing the price and smash buying. And that it is counterintuitive, right? Because like Bitcoin is this global liquidity alarm system in both directions.
Yes.
Due to the nature which you described, it trades 24/7, 365, is extremely liquid. And that is a value prop that people really have not internalized yet, which is like, it's this liquidity alarm bell. And when you have these liquidity events where people need to meet margin, like, yeah, they're going to sell their Bitcoin first because it's the most liquid. They're not going to be able to sell their real estate. It's going to take a lot more time to sell their stocks and get the cash into their account, or you have companies that allow you to liquidate right away and move to your bank account within minutes if you need to. And that in it of itself is an extreme value prop as an asset, just generally and broadly. And again, that's many people, pundits, particularly on CNBC, Bloomberg, think that Bitcoin is this safe haven asset, which it is in the long term, but in the short term, due to its liquidity profile, like it's going to be used if people are worried about their portfolios blowing up somewhere else.
And the beautiful thing is the people that actually understand it, look at the accounts that have over 1,000 Bitcoin or even 100 Bitcoin. What were they doing during this past week when we had this, you know, swift sell-off? They were accumulating, every one of them, right? Because they actually understand the game and they understand what the heck's happening here. And so Bitcoin flows into the hands of people that don't have overexposure to counterparties. It flows into the hands of net producers, people that actually produce profits in the world. And you know, that's the game. Like if you're providing value to society, you're able to acquire more Bitcoin. That's how the game works.
Yeah,
that's how the new game works. That's how the new game works.
Yeah, and if you did that Monday morning when we tipped 49,000, you're already up 20%.
Yeah,
in 4 days, exactly. Less than 4 days, because we're hovering right below 60,000 right now, which is hard to believe. Like, Bitcoin is extremely reflexive in both directions, and
that's right.
Over the long term, more and more people are going to wake up to this, and due to the supply demand dynamics, it's naturally going to go up. And that's just one demand side thing. Like, that was another extremely bullish thing, not only at the conference, but it's becoming more of a wider trend this year, which is companies, particularly publicly traded companies, realizing that Bitcoin is this supreme treasury asset, and Saylor putting the playbook out there and really diving into the logic behind it, basically looking at the book value of his assets at any given point in time, and looking at the premium that that shareholders are putting on that via where the stock price is, and just using that delta to say, all right, we're going to issue converts or shares and buy Bitcoin with that and push that book value up slowly but surely over time. And I think that's another incredibly bullish catalyst for Bitcoin moving forward. And I think it's a trend that's going to accelerate as well, is these publicly traded companies using a MicroStrategy to accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible and actually have that be accretive to shareholders. Because if you do it correctly, the value of your shares as priced in Bitcoin goes up.
Yep. If you're a profitable business, just like at the individual level, if you're a profitable business and you don't have to rely on, next quarter, we're not going to make any money. If they're making money every quarter and they're plowing that excess into Bitcoin, they can go out and they can do riskier things, like, convertible debt. They can go out, they can issue more common stock. Maybe they overpaid and the price was at, 400,000, it came back down to 200,000 for 2 years, and they overpaid for those 2 years, but eventually it comes back. Like, some of those dynamics, you can deal with that if you have a massive treasury like MicroStrategy and you're profitable. You can do these types of things. And it's almost like you have an additional, like, if we were going to look at the balance sheet of a business, we'd say, oh, here's Microsoft. Okay, so they have this asset, which is Microsoft Excel. They've got this asset, which is their data centers. And you'd list out all the assets on their balance sheet that produce these specific revenues and profits. You could make the argument that a company that understands Bitcoin and is profitable almost has like this hidden or secret additional asset on their balance sheet because of their ability to tap into public markets at screaming low yields relative to what an individual would pay, or just, common stock issuance. The fact that they can take some of their common stock when Bitcoin's undervalued and issue it into the market and buy Bitcoin with it, because that dynamic is a play on equities being capitalized at stupid traditional risk-free rate yields at PEs of 35 plus, or 20, even 25, 35 plus. They're being capped based off of this old legacy system. And for people that actually understand how broke that system is and how unrealistic the risk profile is for these market premiums, and their value in the business and Bitcoin, it makes sense to issue common stock and transmute it into Bitcoin, because they know that the cap rates in a Bitcoinized world will most likely be lower than 35 times earnings. So that's that play. That's why it's basically like a hidden mystery asset for a publicly traded company that be able to just go out into the open market and issue more stock, or do, convertible debt deals or whatever.
Yeah. And with that in mind, like, is this a way, like, you manufacture somewhat of a soft landing? It's just everybody's looking at the treasury market, what's going on there, the yen carry trade, the central banks and governments are in this extremely precarious position. And is it on the free market in terms of individual companies sort of saving themselves, letting the debt situation run its course as quickly or slowly as it needs to? And then you look back at some point in the next decade or two, it's like, oh, all the companies that acquired Bitcoin as quickly as possible are still standing, and the ones that didn't are in a much worse off position. But the net of the net effect of the companies that decide to do it doing it is actually massively beneficial, because they're able to still provide valuable services and goods to the market. And if they sort of kept piggybacking on the dependence of governments and central banks to properly maintain their systems, that they get left behind.
You can see the smirk on my face. So I think that for this to have a backstop and for it to more gradually transition over to a Bitcoinized world in a, is it more stable? I don't know. There's arguments for both sides of that. But let's say that you have this, the Bitcoin provides this backstop to the legacy debauchery, and it like slowly transitions over to this new system. For that to happen, I think there's two things that need to play out. First, governments actually have to understand why they need to do this on a collective level, especially the large G7 type countries. They have to deeply understand why they need to back it, why they actually need a market on the long end of the debt curve, like all of those things. They have to understand that. So is that possible? Sure. Are we there right now? I don't think we're even close. Maybe that's me just being pessimistic. I don't know. But I don't think they're even close to taking a step in that direction, even though like Kennedy's laid it out. Like he's laid that out, that he thinks that the yield, the long end of the curve needs to be backed and all that kind of stuff. So you do have people talking about it. I'm just very suspect of whether you can do this for a majority of these nation states without there being a race, almost like a gold rush to Bitcoin, which then accelerates everything. Okay. So that's the first concern. The second point would be you have to then convince the marginal buyers that they need to assume this risk of buying the long end of the curve and not just buying the short duration, the strategy that I was describing earlier, where like Paulo was like smirking at me and laughing at me. He's like, why would I do that? I don't have to think that hard. I can just take this really low risk approach and just keep only buying the short duration stuff. And so the two of those things combined is why I'm a little skeptical as to whether it's going to serve as a backstop for this like slow transition over to this new system. But again, I might be, I'm a hardcore Bitcoiner like everybody else. And maybe I'm biased, whatever, but those are the two things that I think have to happen in order for it to maybe slow roll a little bit. And that's not my base case.
No. It's not mine either, trying to put white pills out there. But another white pill is like that doesn't happen and you have this massive reset of asset valuations, particularly hard assets that people need to produce goods and services in the economy. And I think Ter Demeester has articulated this the best, is that as the price of Bitcoin goes up, like in terms of where Bitcoiners stand on the economic rungs, just they get higher and higher in terms of where they fall in the top 10%, top 5%, top 1%, 0.1%. Eventually, as Bitcoin gets into six figures, and you have to imagine Bitcoiners were smart enough to get into Bitcoin at any point between 2009 and now, and that was a wise decision from an economic perspective. And if you do have a calamity in markets and people are forced sellers of assets, Bitcoiners can swoop in, get them at good valuations, and hopefully run good businesses and come in and be the Warren Buffetts of the late 2020s, early 2030s in terms of coming in, buying cheap assets and making sure that they actually run profitably, because Bitcoiners have that mindset. Like Bitcoin is the opportunity cost. I'm going to go buy something. It better be producing cash flows and profits that I can shovel back into Bitcoin.
One thing's for sure, just by the sheer way that the fractional reserve legacy system works, there are so many zombies out there business-wise that, they're going to be just decapitated in this transition, like massively decapitated. And when I look at this, especially from an infrastructure standpoint, when you look at the US or you look at Europe and you look at a lot of like developed nation states, they're going to have to retool all of that infrastructure through this transition where, you know, a lot of these businesses would have just gone belly up if there wasn't this fiat printing press just keeping everybody alive and basically like a mother bird just feeding all the babies all day long. So that transition of all that CapEx, all that physical stuff is going to be quite a burden for developed nation states. The global South, where you don't have as much infrastructure and you are almost starting from like a clean slate, I think that that's going to be a tremendous benefit as more and more capital flows into these markets. And I think that it's going to be a benefit because they don't have to retool and re-engineer something. It'd almost be like I have a complex machine behind me, and through this transition, I have to figure out a way to like still make it useful, and I have to re-gear it and do all these types of things. And that's a lot of work. That's a lot of effort to do that. But if I could just literally start from nothing, it's actually, I can build it way more efficiently and more quickly and more effectively for the value prop to society. So I think that's a little bit of the yin and the yang for like what it's going to be like to go through this transition from a very developed nation state versus one that's not. It's going to be interesting to see how the world basically retools itself and re-engineers itself from an infrastructure standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. I have dreams. Tor and I have dreams of, starting a brick factory we had an event at the Commons earlier this year with Austin Tunnell, who does incredible brick masonry. And one of the things he said is like, in this fiat world where look at like, where I'm at right now, this house was built 20 years ago, plastic siding, plastic dividers. Oh, yeah. The incentives were such, you just buy the cheap crap and disincentivize the more expensive but more durable building materials like brick. And that's one thing that Austin helped us realize, is that like it's hard for him to find good brick because there's no brick factories anymore because everybody's been disincentivized. And that's one thing where, yes, the topics that we're talking about can be heavy in the sense that we're talking about a debt spiral and economic collapse, and not economic collapse, but a repricing of many assets, companies, and financial assets that exist in the world. But it's a necessary re-architecting of the incentives to go invest and build not only durable companies, but companies that produce durable goods that can lead to durable housing and other things in the economy.
Yeah, totally. What worked before is completely antithetical to what's going to work moving forward. And I think if you were looking at, where did that pendulum peak and where is it starting to swing back? I think that COVID might be a pretty good, 2020, you basically had the fixed income markets peg themselves at like 50 bips on the 10-year treasury. I would say that that was literally the peak of the bull market in fixed income of the legacy system. And I think everything spinning the opposite way from here on out is only going to pick up steam. So, you know, how did you make money in masonry? Well, you came up with the cheapest cost cutting that still looked like it was real brick, even though it wasn't. It was just complete garbage. That worked, especially at the very end of that cycle. So like, what's going to work moving forward? Well, that stuff is still going to work as we're coming out of this. But as you get further and further, 10 years from now, like there's going to be demand for like higher quality building materials because the pendulum's now swinging the other way. And so people that are listening to this that are wanting to create value in society moving forward, I would just tell you, like, take a close look, examine what worked really well for the last 40 years, invert it, and try to make sure that you get your timing right, because a lot of the incentives are just being completely rewired, almost like you microdosed a human's brain and it's like rewiring itself or something.
Yeah. And I think we particularly have a front row seat to this, being involved with 1031 and ego death and applying this framework to the businesses that we're investing in that are building Bitcoin infrastructure. And that's why I feel very fortunate to have the position that I do at 1031. And I'm sure you feel the same way with ego death, is that the founders that we're backing are hardcore Bitcoiners and internalized this inversion that you just described. Like Bitcoin is the hurdle rate, not only for investments that you're making in public equities markets or anywhere else, but if you're building a company and you have to allocate capital to hire new people or invest in certain R&D, you have to weigh the opportunity cost of, does it make sense to spend this on a new hire, a new R&D effort, or should I just buy Bitcoin? And that really forces the leaders of these companies and the people working with, within these companies to be as efficient as possible from a capital allocation.
Yeah, it better be a value prop, because if it's not, like, good luck outpacing 50% or whatever hurdle rate you want to assign to Bitcoin. But I would say it's like 50% annualized. Good luck. Like, that's one hell of a hurdle rate. I did traditional investing for all these years before I even came into Bitcoin. And it was like, you know, a hurdle rate of like 10% was pretty aggressive. 15%, that was like, you were performing really well. And like 50% was like, literally you get laughed out of the room. But like, I know from an investment standpoint, especially in early like startups, like if it's not that, like, I'm sorry, it's just not enough. It's not enough of a return to like,
I mean, Jack Mallers from Strike, he spoke at the park at our event early. He had it even higher. He's like, our hurdle rate, like 65%. It's like when we allocate capital, it's like, do you think that this investment, this new hire, this new product can create 65% growth on our revenues? And it's like, holy crap, when you put it that way. But that, just like having that framework alone is, again, a complete inversion to the way of the VC world for the last 3 to 4 decades, which was raise as much money as possible. Don't worry about revenue. Don't worry about profitability. Just acquire new users and pump those monthly active user numbers as much as possible.
Marty, this is the crazy part, is people who are listening to this would be like, well, that's because they're in VC, right? But I can tell you right now, if you don't think Michael Saylor's hurdle rate's at like 50% for what he does with his profits, you don't understand Michael Saylor and you don't understand what he's doing. Because even as a large cap company, and I would argue this is for every company in the world right now, their hurdle rate is 50%, whether they know it or not. Like, that's the hurdle rate, at least in my humble opinion.
And I think it's safe to say most people do not understand that that's their hurdle rate. They're probably making unwise decisions.
No way. No way. Yeah.
So where do you think we go this cycle? Because I've talked about this on a couple shows this week, but it really hit me at the conference. We did a live rabbit hole recap, and that was a great sort of event to compare to the first Bitcoin conference in 2019 in San Francisco, where we also did a live rabbit hole recap. And in Nashville this year, we sold out a venue, 600 plus people, incredible show. In 2019, the conference was literally in a parking garage in San Francisco, and we did the live show on a picnic bench with really cheap mics. And it was just literally, there was probably like 50 to 75 people huddled around this picnic bench while we're doing a live show.
The glory days.
Yeah, the glory days. But it was only 5 years ago. And to think that in just 5 years, this conference went from a parking garage in San Francisco, where the keynote speaker was Alex Mashinsky, Zach Prince. And now fast forward 5 years, it's in Nashville, tens of thousands of people, presidential candidates speaking and talking about how they want to acquire Bitcoin. Like, this is what hyper Bitcoinization looks like.
Yeah,
and
totally.
When you're in the industry and you're involved in the day-to-day minutia of trying to push things forward, it can get, I don't want to say disheartening, but you can lose perspective of how fast things are actually happening. And I think this year's conference for me personally was a huge zoom out moment. Like, holy crap, we've come a long way in a relatively short amount of time, which then begs the question, like, where do we go from here? Like, if it's accelerating like this and you have all these fundamental structural problems in the incumbent financial and government debt arena, like,
the thing is it's not linear. So like, when we're looking at the data point from 5 years ago to this data point, people would look at that and be like, okay, so in 5 years maybe it's here. It's not linear. This is exponential. So whatever growth we had over those last 5 years, it's going to even be more aggressive in the coming 5 years. Like, I think it's going to be way more aggressive. And, you know, you can continue to listen to this stuff and sit around and be like, yeah, I can't refute anything they're saying and then not take action. Or you can take action. And people need to take action, especially right now. I think by the end of 2025, it's going to be gangbusters, man. I don't know what price it is in fiat terms, but I think that the last cycle had a lot of shenanigans. I think the last cycle had a lot of government shenanigans that were disguised as corporate shenanigans. And what evidence I have for that, I have zero evidence for that. It's just a hunch. But if true, and if there were, you know, a bunch of selling that normally wouldn't have happened without, you know, some real mysterious and bad actors involved, because what that created, in my humble opinion, is a whole lot more selling than what you would have saw. And I think you had a whole lot of supply suffocation that's happened through that process. Heck, I even think that you have a lot of that still happening, especially with these the size of these ETFs, the fact that they never have an outflow day. They just, you know, they just keep stacking more Bitcoin per share of ETF that's out there. The fact that you have Germany, you know, basically dumping their bags, and then the next week the Department of Justice is dumping their bags, and, you know, all the lawyers will tell you, oh, it was forecasted. We should have known this was I'm looking at it and I'm saying this whole freaking thing is so corrupted and so orchestrated so that the people that have finally figured out what the heck's happening. And let me preface this. I think people that control a lot of buying power in the world have finally figured this out. And I think that they're doing everything that they can to take a position size. Now, whether it's a large position size or what, or just a hedge, I don't know, but they're figuring it out. Just look at the people that came to the conference in Nashville. Like, they're figuring it out. So hang on, because you can only mask things for so long, especially when the entire blockchain of Bitcoin is auditable. You can see how many coins there are. You can see the public addresses, and hang on. I think it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah. And it has been interesting. Again, the 5-year change has been massive. Like you just mentioned, the people that were at this conference were not at the conference 5 years ago. And that's a bit disconcerting for some people that have been around for a while, but I think it's important to help Bitcoiners that have been around for a while or sort of uncomfortable with the people that are coming to Bitcoin understand, like, this is, like you said, an open permissionless system, and mm-hmm. the value prop of Bitcoin is so strong that you have to expect that these people are going to wake up to it and want to get exposure to it as well. And it's not a bad thing. If anything, it's a validation of everything we've been opining about for the last 15 years. It's people are finally waking up to it. Yes, you may not agree with how their businesses have been run and what they've done to the financial system up to this point, but like you just mentioned, they realize something's wrong, and there's only one escape route, and it's via Bitcoin, and they're going to use that if they understand that and have access to it.
They're finally getting wrecked in fixed income. Like, it's been an absolute bludgeoning, and that's the trade that's always worked for their entire life. And I think that reckoning over since 2022, like, where they're just getting crushed, is one of the main reasons why they're desperately searching, because they're looking at equities and they're saying, oh, I don't want to pay 35 times earnings. Like, those yields are, you know, absurd. Like, they're terrible. Is it going to keep going up in nominal fiat terms? Yeah, it's probably going to go to PEs of 45 on this next, you know, 2 years or 3 years. It's only going to get crazier. But they're looking at this and they understand the math, and they're saying, I got to go somewhere. There has to be something out there. Like, how does this thing resolve itself? I'm getting my face ripped off on all these bonds that I used to make so much money on. And that's why some of them are slowly starting to figure out that this is where this is all moving. And I think that's only going to get more and more emphasized as fixed income becomes even more terrible moving forward, which it definitely will. So,
yeah. Yeah. And this is, again, it's disconcerting for a lot of people, but you have to expect it. Like, anybody can use it. Yeah. They're going to use it. And this is beneficial overall. People worry about all of this, all of Wall Street getting into Bitcoin, being a threat to the decentralized and permissionless nature of the protocol, but just be vigilant and make sure that you're doing your part to support open source wallet projects, help distribute hash rate as much as possible, run your full node. And it's counterintuitive, but all of this money coming in is also massively beneficial for the small individuals who are using Bitcoin, whether that's here in the US or in emergent markets. Like, Bitcoin price going up benefits everybody who holds Bitcoin, the large institutions and the plebs, if you will. And
Marty, everything you just said is how you actually vote. That's modern voting right there. Right. If somebody says, Preston, did you vote? No, I run my own full node. Of course I voted.
Yeah.
Like, that's how you do it. Like, we have got to suck the monetary energy out of this disgusting beast, which is the legacy fiat, fractional reserve, credit-based boondoggle system. And run your own node. You know, if you can mine, like, do everything you can to support this system. And ensure its decentralization. And I just don't know how else you can go about making a better world than doing those activities that you described.
No. And I do think there are people not only on Wall Street, but within the government. I think the park, the fireside conversations that happened at the park with Cynthia Lummis, Senator Hagerty, Governor Bill Lee, the Attorney General of Tennessee, Mr. Liash from the Tennessee Valley Authority, like, particularly at the state level, there are politicians that recognize that things are pretty bad at the federal level, and they're doing their best to basically bolster their local economies and recognize that Bitcoin is a way to do that. And they want to be receiving Bitcoin businesses and individuals with open arms and actually working with the industry. That's, a lot of people thought the conference was a lot of pandering, which there definitely was a lot of pandering. And there were many politicians in town that week to raise money for their campaigns heading into an election season. But there was also genuine engagement in terms of an open two-way conversation, at least between the politicians from Tennessee and the community, really trying to constructively walk through, like, what can we do to make business easier for you? And how can you guys help us achieve some of our goals, particularly around power generation expansion and things like that.
Huge shout out to Rod, to Matt Odell, all the people there at, and Josh at Bitcoin Park. These guys are, wow. If you've never been to Bitcoin Park in Nashville, I can't talk it up enough. It's unbelievable. And if there's a state that has their act together, it is Tennessee. These people, I can't even tell you how many times I've been to Bitcoin Park and somebody, either the senator themselves are there or somebody from their staff is there, trying to truly learn, like, what is this movement all about? Like, it's not fake. Like, I've been up there enough times to, like, be able to tell, like, do they just want money or are they actually trying to understand this? And I'm telling you, it's both. They probably do want money, but they're really trying to understand it, like, deeply. At least 8 times I've been up there, and every time somebody from the staff of a US senator or a representative is there trying to understand it. So that's bullish. Like, hey, that's good. Like, am I pandering to them? Of course not. Like, hey, if they figure it out, they figure it out. But there are people, especially in the state of Tennessee, that are really leaning into this. Some other states have a lot to figure out.
Yeah. And that's what you want to see too. The grassroots, you don't need a diktat from the federal level to say, all right, you guys can play with this thing, have fun playing with your Bitcoin and your crypto, and we're going to give you the green light. Like, that is a manifestation of a grassroots movement, an individual state saying, all right, we're going to do the homework. We're not going to be dependent on the federal government to lead the way here. We're gonna do our own homework and try to lead ourselves and make sure that we're not dependent on anybody outside of these borders.
I'm laughing because you said play with your Bitcoin. which was the Trump quote. Yeah. God.
They're so telling me you're all so playing, stupid. You're having fun playing with your Bitcoin.
So stupid.
Oh yeah. It was, but I was there for a speech, and it felt like a 30-minute stand-up set with some policy talk at the end.
There was, yeah. There was a feel like that, yeah.
Yeah. And he did acknowledge something that I think was like a good signal, which is that like what you guys have done in 15 years, and paraphrasing here obviously, but the vitality of the community and the love of freedom and really trying to take action to make sure that freedom reigns in the United States is inspiring. And
yeah,
it's not going to be easy. I think again, harkening back to all the structural financial problems that we discussed earlier, like it's not going to be easy. It's going to take rolling up your sleeves, getting your hands dirty, and actually going out there and building the new system that we will eventually transition to. It's not going to be a smooth ride, but it can be. You can make it smoother by rolling up your sleeves and getting to work.
I think the biggest challenge this country in particular has, and really any kind of developed nation at this point, the biggest challenge that they have isn't getting Bitcoin on their balance sheet or incorporating it into the yield curve. Like all those things are solutions. The real issue is the cognitive conditioning of the free handout. How do you turn that around quickly when everybody, not everybody, I hate using the word everybody, a large portion of the populace has become addicted to the money printer, to the heroin of the money printer? That's going to be the thing that's really difficult, because let's say you load up the treasury with Bitcoin and you well positioned yourself and all these things, which you can't just turn on a dime, like what I just described, which is having a Bitcoin strategy, is the minds of all these people that are looking for a handout. That's the thing that's going to be really challenging, because those are the people that are going to drain that treasury faster than you can blink your eye.
Yeah. And something I think about often is like, I think it's objectively true. You have to find a way to make a convincing argument that all these handouts are making them worse off. I mean, obviously yeah. We have sites like WTF happened in 1971. Thomas Sowell has been beating this drum for decades, but there's a bunch of cognitive dissonance that exists that for some reason or another doesn't enable people to realize that this is actually not the long-term benefit of their overall quality of life or economic standing. And I think we don't need to think tank this, but they're trying to think through like what is the killer narrative in terms of helping people realize that this actually is not good for you, despite the fact that you think it may be.
That's the thing that doesn't turn on a dime. That's the thing that's going to take time, because you have to recondition them to think in terms of long term as opposed to short term interest at the expense of the long term, and self responsibility. And self-ownership, like all of those things are wrapped into that issue that plagues developed nations right now.
Yeah. I mean, you just look over to Venezuela, what was a very strong developed economy at the beginning of this century, did not take long for it to devolve into a hellscape, less than two decades. And I think that's what people in the United States have to realize and come to grips with, is we're not immune to that. Like that could happen here, and we may be in the process of that happening here, just the earlier stages of like Venezuela 2006, 2007.
Yeah, totally.
So are you optimistic?
Am I optimistic for myself and my family and like my close friends that are big? Yes, very optimistic. Am I optimistic on a net basis for society? I don't know. I am long term for sure. In the short term, I think there's plenty of pain to kind of come. So I guess it's a nuanced. I'm not trying to avoid the question, but it's very nuanced depending on like what scale or like what level I'm kind of viewing it. But you know, I think that it's very optimistic that we're going to have a way more fair system through all of this, way more fair and way more constructive. because at the end of the day, if you create value, like you get to, you know, keep it, and you can use it on a rainy day, however you see fit, as opposed to it just constantly being stolen out of your pocket without you being able to control it. So it's very exciting from that regard. I'm very optimistic with respect to that.
Yeah. We're going to win. It's going to take time. It's going to be a bumpy road, but we're the generation that has to, to suffer the consequences of over a century of poor capital allocation and decisions at the monetary system level. You can't pick it. It's not like you're born. You can pick to be born at a particular point in time, but it's just something we have to deal with. And I think, like you said, the quicker people recognize this and make the mental switch to be productive and try to work on the solutions, the better. There are definitely multiple paths through which this transition can go, longer, shorter, medium term. And I think it's up to individuals taking agency and really internalizing these ideas and taking action that will dictate what the transition looks like and how quickly or slowly it happens.
Yeah. Just take ownership. Like you can make this just an incredible experience for yourself moving forward. You know, you just have to take self-responsibility. You have to provide value for the world, and then you have to, you know, store that value in something that's desirable and accretive. And I think we know what that last part is. Maybe some of the other stuff people have to sort out. But Marty, if I could pick any point in time to live, like, this is it, baby. This is it. Like, why in the world would you not want to be in this moment right now? This is insane. This is incredible. How exciting.
As Lord Littlefinger Baelish once said, chaos is a ladder.
That's right.
You can climb that ladder if you know what you're doing at this particular juncture in time, which, Preston, right. I think you're doing an incredible job to help people wake up to this. So really appreciate you coming on and talking through these ideas today, because it was a joy hanging out with you at the park in Nashville and talking about some of these ideas. And
likewise,
the most exciting thing is, like, you're Bitcoiners are very solutions focused, and that's what gives me optimism. Like, ideas don't stick immediately, but you're thinking of ways to get creative, think out of the box, and help drive solutions to a world with structural problems.
Well, thank you for that, and I feel the same way about you, buddy. Truly, this has been just fun. Really fun. And I'm looking forward to playing darts with you in Riga, by the way.
Yes. Preston, I think Paul Toy is going to be there too. Maybe we can get him.
We need to get the gang together and play our darts.
Yeah. To let you know, I've been practicing. My cousin has a dartboard in his garage down here. We've been playing all summer.
Did you play baseball? Oh, you've been playing baseball. Okay.
Yeah.
Not killer. My favorite game.
Yeah. And that's where you get, like, preordained numbers, and you got to.
Yes.
You
throw it. Yeah. You throw it. Yeah. You get your number that you threw. Yeah. And then it's try to kill the other players.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fun game. All right. Darts in 2 weeks in Riga. Can't wait. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir. And appreciate you bringing me on your platform. I really do.
All right. Peace and love, freaks. Okay.